I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello everyone, I'm Stephen Robb and you're all very welcome along to the Tillage Podcast. It's currently Thursday morning, the 20th of April 2022. The sun is shining and the latest edition of the Irish Farmers Journal newspaper is in shops. And as always, here to discuss your key tillage news stories of the week and much more, I'm delighted to be joined by my colleagues Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh. So guys, another good week. Good to see you, but I think the question is beginning to arise now. Are we under pressure for moisture? Certainly that was the theme off from the tram lines this week. Bit of a north-south contrast, but we can get into that later. What are you hearing from the growers that you're talking and from the crops that you're seeing over the past week? Are crops beginning to come under pressure?
I think so, Stephen. Like spring barley, certainly around this area, and I was all along the east coast this week from Ardee then to South Wexford, and yeah, I think crops could do with moisture. That wind is drying up fields. I think spring barley crops are struggling. I think winter barley has kind of halted to some extent, which maybe is no harm as well because it was flying through the growth stages. But I think maybe it's lacking some of its nitrogen as a result of the lack of rain. So I think, yeah, definitely crops could do with a bit of moisture. I'm not one to ask for rain, and I know in other parts of the country it maybe you could do without it, but I think certainly crops would do with a drop.
Yeah, I go along with that, Stephen. I think that the you know, Siobhan's comment about the easterly wind, that kind of has changed everything over the past week. It made very nice looking crops kind of look a bit more pressurized, almost to the point of causing little bits of damage on leaf edges and stuff like that. I suppose it's worth noting at this point that this week last year, we were in rather almost exactly the same situation, if not even slightly more severe, with patches already beginning to appear in winter barley fields in dry tops of hills and that types of thing. Again, like Siobhan, I'm kind of pretty reluctant always to go praying for rain, but it's going to fall sometime, and we need some during the growing season. And, you know, now is a good time to be getting it before crops are kind of forced to lose any yield potential.
Yeah, but I guess, you know, in terms of nitrogen, for example, I mean, the key issue in spring barley at the moment is that nitrogen is not, or spring cereals, as you say, nitrogen is not getting washed in, it's not breaking down. Is that going to cause, one way or another now, is that going to cause issues later on, maybe in terms of protein levels or anything like that?
That will remain uncertain until harvest. You know, the theory is yes, but it depends a little bit on when it will be washed in. I've always been kind of amazed at the amount of people who say that nitrogen is still on the top of the ground because the clay that carried it is still there. The nitrogen is not necessarily there, but it depends on getting a little bit of rain or a little bit of rain with a good bit of dew to get it dissolved and to get it moved into the ground. But I think, you know, I've always said it's the risk always associated with putting any fertilizer on the top of the ground is that if it stays in the very surface of the ground in that very dry layer, the layer that's almost always dry, nutrients cannot be taken from dry soil. You need them down in the seedbed. And that's why, you know, there's the general recommendation, put compounds into the seedbed, either compound drill or at least incorporate it, so your crop has something to keep it going until the flush becomes available from the top dressing that's washed in. I think this year, you know, most areas or many areas have not really had much nitrogen, much rain to wash in nitrogen. Now I know there's a few exceptions to that because I was in some fields where the nitrogen was obviously spread in wet conditions, possibly even during rain, to get it into the seedbed. But a lot of it is still probably sitting on the surface.
Yeah, and just, you know, whenever you mentioned the comparison with last year, I guess winter crops, because they've come through the autumn and the winter in such good condition, surely they're better established and maybe more braced for a dry period if this dry period continues.
I wouldn't see a major problem with moisture availability for a while yet, except again for the tips of the hills on the very light fields. You know, they were planted early. They've had terrific autumn growth, a big root system. I think they're going to be pretty well braced for as much moisture as a particular soil can hold at this point.
I think some winter crops could do with a little bit of moisture probably to wash in that last bit of nitrogen, but in general, I think they're looking very well. And you know, Gio has awns out there now at the minute. It was really interesting the other night. I was at the Drummond's Chagas crop walk, and you know, we could see the varieties in the field and the difference in the timings. Gio is way ahead of everything else there. Most of the others are still a flag leaf.
But it's important, I think, to make the comment, Siobhan, that while Gio will show awns early, last year we all expected it also to ripen earlier and to be the first cut, but it certainly wasn't the first cut. It was the second or third variety cut. So there's quite a long period for Jayu between awns appearing and harvest, longer than most other varieties. And we just need to be a bit careful with the timing of final fungicides, etc., not to be caught out at the end with diseases like yellow rust, etc. Brown rust, etc.
Yeah, there's a long way to go still. You wouldn't be rushing out, Andy, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing before we just chat about what's to come, I woke up to frost this morning, so I did, and I believe there's frost in other parts of the country as well. You know, are we, especially with the likes of Joyu, which, you know, on's emerging, be quite delicate, you know, are we at risk of seeing some frost damage this year?
I don't particularly think so, Stephen, because the kind of nearly everywhere in the country is having frost most nights, but most people don't see it because it's kind of cleared and gone shortly after sunup. So unless you're on the move very early, you don't see it. But certainly temperatures are way down there at twos and ones for sure, and probably sub-zeros as well in places. I think that we're getting... The fact that the weather is cold during the day is kind of climatizing crops, quite like we do with horticultural plants to harden them up. The big risk is a frost that comes out of nowhere and very warm conditions during the day. That's where the real big risk is. I'm not expecting that there would be. Now, I could be proven wrong because nature does all kinds of things that we can't explain. But I wouldn't be expecting that blank grains in winter barleys at the moment would be a major, major problem.
Okay, and in terms of what else we're seeing in the fields, you know, in terms of sowing or in terms of winter crop husbandry, or indeed any other kind of management tips that growers need to be thinking about or aware of, what are we seeing? I know up here in the northwest, where there's still a lot of guys sowing cereals, although it is winding down. I myself, we're beet at the moment, so we are, and many guys around the country are still at beet. A little bit of maize going in as well, from what I can see, and indeed still a lot of spuds going in up here. The majority, close to the majority maybe, of main crop spuds are in at this stage. They'll certainly be in by the end of the week, I would think, around the rest of the country. What are you seeing out and about?
Yeah, maize this week, I think, really took off. I travelled some of the same roads this week as last week, and you could see, you know, where maize had started last week, there's a lot of maize has been planted since. Beets going well as well. I'm continuing to be amazed at the increase in the oil seed rape. Maybe I'll be proven wrong in the BPS figures, but there just seems to be an awful lot more winter oil seed rape And just, I suppose, you're talking on management. I suppose, you know, people should be holding off on their weed spray if they can, you know, until another flush of rain comes to try and bring those weeds up in their spring crops. But at the same time, I suppose I'm conscious of nutrition, and you know, if crops are traditionally low in magnesium or manganese, that'll need to go on early as well. So I suppose the you know, rain preferable, I suppose, before you go with the herbicide, but be conscious that crops are going to need a bit of nutrition as well.
But with most days being spraying days, Siobhan, you know, there is the possibility that people could run over twice if needs be, but certainly there's not a lot of point in putting on herbicides on a field where the weeds are not present. No. Because we're not using residuals, you know, you need them to be there to kill them. So there may be a need, you know, if land is beginning to get dry, as in you can see leaves beginning to kind of roll over on themselves to conserve moisture, in that type of a scenario, you're almost looking at the inevitability of trace element deficiencies on a lot of land. Mm-hmm. And if you don't move before that happens, then you're looking at a permanent hit on yield potential. Yeah. In that field. So, you know, be it, particularly for trace elements, and where people know they'll have a problem, they must move. But people who only occasionally get problems may also need to move this year because of the fact that this dryness is beginning to bite in plants and crops that still have a relatively shallow root system. If the root system was bigger before this dryness bit, then it might not be so bad. But it's on newer crops, fresher crops, younger crops, two-leaf, three-leaf stage, they can bite pretty hard at this stage.
Mm.
Yeah, okay. Look, normally talk about this at the end of the podcast, but seeing as the majority of the conversation here is revolving around the weather, let's bring forward the weather forecast. A lot of guys, a lot of growers were anticipating a splash of rain this weekend. Siobhan, I think you said it tried to rain last night with you. What's the weather forecast saying, Andy? Are we still in line for this much awaited moisture?
Well, I can only judge by what's in the forecast in the Farmers Journal, Stephen, because that's all I can see at the moment. But certainly the forecast is talking about rain for most areas, I suppose, for most areas that might want it. And that includes you, even though you say you don't. You know, there's rain there for Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But a lot of those days, the quantities are small, and there may not be an awful lot of rain fall. And just judging by it and just reading the text of the forecast, it's showers. You might get them and you might not get them. It doesn't look like there's kind of a guaranteed band of rain going to run across the country. I also note from looking at it, because I watch it a good deal, is Metairn's monthly forecast. And up to very recently, they were talking about kind of significant broken weather affecting the country in the first 3 weeks in May. That the rainfall that was there seems to have reduced very considerably, and indeed from reading the forecast this morning might not be there. And even if it was to rain, and in reading the forecast for the last few weeks, it seemed much more like the rain was coming in from the west, and it might not make the easterly areas where the bulk of the tillage and certainly the bulk of the light land is. So I'm kind of more worried about moisture availability going forward now than I was a week ago, when the forecast into the future was quite different. So look, that's what's there on rainfall for the moment. You know, all of next week, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, there's kind of rain in all of the regions. But as I said earlier, amounts are small. It might not happen at all. And if it was a shower, it might not fall on you. Just looking at other things, wind speeds kind of dropping way down for the remainder of this week, rising a bit again next week, wind remaining from the east, which is what's causing so much problems. Wheat crops for the bulk of this week, then going back into the north and the west. So there's kind of not a lot of joy in terms of softness or rain there. And then spinning back around towards the east again as we get into the middle of next week. So, you know, there's not that much joy in it, but temperatures generally higher, not massively higher, but higher early next week, kind of pushing up into the 16s, 17s. And then as we get back into the easterly wind, dropping back towards 12s for day and 6 by night again. But certainly the very lows that we've been experiencing for the last while seem to be dropping off the minimum temperature levels. And that's a plus, because that certainly was putting the handbrake on the development that we thought we might see because of the nice sunny days that we were looking at. Frost at night kind of held up everything. So that's pretty much it as I see it for the moment.
Andy, just on that, you know, if we are potentially in store for a drier than anticipated May, and I know it's all subject to change, but, you know, do you see justification for maybe a preemptive, you know, trace element spray, especially in the areas where you know you could have problems in a dry spell?
I certainly do, Stephen. You know, I think that it's almost preemptive everywhere. Indeed, trace element application should always be preemptive. Where at all possible, because once you see symptoms, you've lost yield potential, particularly in spring crops at that stage. So yes, I think that one of the things I like to think of using the multi-element mixes in that type of a scenario. It doesn't take a lot of nutrient to keep a deficiency away. It takes more to hinder it. But remember always that when you get one deficiency, you're affecting the whole plant metabolism, which automatically means that others can equally become a problem, even though you don't see the symptom, because the symptom is seen as the dominant symptom for the dominant deficiency. But you can have all kinds of other implications. And I've always been a fan of the multi-element mixtures because they seem to solve more problems than one in the single application. So I would certainly be advising people to go. If people have a good bit of compound fertilizer, a good bit of nitrogen applied as a compound fertilizer into the seed bed, and it's washed in and reasonably well incorporated, I don't really think that there should be any major advantage in adding the major nutrients to those mixes, to those stress element mixes, because there are products with those things available in them. But if you have a post-planting compound application, and there's bound to be some of them out there, there may be advantage from trying to get a little bit of P and K in those mixes to try and keep the plant ticking over in a healthy state for a bit longer. But I would advise people, if you know you're in any kind of a risk at all, go. The people probably least in risk are the ones that would have done a good bit with organic manures over the past number of years, where the structure is nice and soft and the roots can grow more rapidly through it than through the tighter, more worn ground. They're the areas that carry the bigger risk at the moment.
Okay, excellent, Andy. Thank you for that. Now, we're going to move away from our national lens here for a moment and go to a local lens. We're going to head to South Wexford, down to a former tramline tillage farmer, Vivian Turbot. Siobhan, this week Chagas Owen Lyons is writing for us. He's writing a crop on camera. Tell us, what's the main points? What's he seeing?
Yeah, so Owen is doing crop on camera this year. I suppose we did crop on camera last year, so Owen has taken up the mantle now this year, and he's following a crop of spring malt and barley down in South Wexford, so on Vivian Turbot's farm. And look, the crop was sown on the 18th of March. That's when Vivian started sowing, and I suppose Owen chose that crop because we want a crop that's kind of, it's probably one of the earlier sown crops in the country, and we want other farmers to be able to follow the program. Progress, and I suppose if they read Vivian's, it might be ahead of theirs, and they might be able to follow the advice the following week. So I suppose just Owen was really giving us an introduction this week. So the crop was drilled at a seed rate of 187 kgs on the 18th of March, and there's pictures in the paper there, so you can look at them. It's in the middle of April, I suppose, the nitrogen application was finished at the two-leaf stage, and it was brought up to 150 kgs or 120 units per acre. And I suppose Vivian has proof of the higher yields there, so he's able to push on the nitrogen. So the next thing now is broadleaf weed control and wild oak control. So you know he's aiming to do that. You know, fairly soon he has weeds up. I suppose it's an earlier sown crop, so you know what the issues we talked about earlier on maybe aren't there. So when the crop's at the four leaf stage, he's going to apply a herbicide, and he's probably going to you know to go with something like Galaxy or Universe along with an SU, so he can go out with his wild oat spray at the same time. So that's kind of where the crop is at the minute, and we'll follow it throughout the year with Owen.
Yeah, excellent. I like the fact that he has chosen early country and an early part of the world, so that, as you rightly said, you know, whatever's happening on his farm and with that crop, you know, it might not have happened yet on some of our readers' farms. So it might just give you an indication of kind of what to do and where to go, and just general things to think about. Excellent. Read all that and much more in this week's Tillage Pages in the Irish Farmers Journal. And also in this week's Tillage Pages, I have a wee piece in Double Page Spread on the new range of potato chemistry that's coming down the line from BASF. So a few weeks ago, I attended a industry briefing from David Leahy and Paul Goddard, a few other members of BASF's technical team. And basically, they give us an insight into what's coming down the line in terms of chemistry for potatoes. So potatoes, like every other crop, they really are coming under pressure from active availability. So chemicals, actives that we're all used to using and developing our management approaches around are being whipped from under our feet at a fairly rapid rate. Diquat obviously being the big one, which we lost in the past couple of years. So it is reassuring to see that there are new products coming down the line. So there's a lot more detail on the Tillage Pages naturally. So, but I'll, for the purposes of this podcast, I'll just run through a few bits and pieces on the products. So I suppose one of the products, I suppose, which will be out this year is Enervin. And Enervin is for late blight. Should be available for the 2022 season. It's a protectant spray, so works best obviously early in the early stages of a foliar late blight. Seems to work well earlier on in a blight control program. And I suppose it kind of frees up other existing chemistry, which might be more useful for later on in the blight control program. So it has a place. So it does. I suppose crucially, look, it's a single site mode of action. So it is. So in order to protect the chemistry, it's more important than ever to add it in with another form of chemistry with a different mode of action, pretty much to protect it. Lots more details, as I say, on the pages. Moving on, we have another blight product, BAS657. Not named just yet because not registered just yet, but they are hoping that it's going to be available in 2024. This is a combination of Enervin's active ingredient, amitrotrazine. Sorry, David, if I haven't pronounced that right, along with potassium phosphonate. So basically, this is a combination of protective and systemic chemistry. So it's actually going to be really useful. And we think it can kind of slot in. Well, again, it kind of slots in fairly well early in the spray program. But because it's kind of got that two modes of action as such, it's a lot more flexible, so it is. Moving on, so we're all quite familiar with Revazol for cereals. Well, Revazol will be available for potatoes, hopefully in 2023, and where this is quite useful, it's in the early blight. So early blight, Alternaria, hasn't really been an issue for many growers, let's be honest, in the country, because we had Mancozeb about kind of a widely used multi-site That's all changed now because Michael Seb is gone. So we could potentially see early blight becoming a problem. But Revazol, once it's cleared for use, will deliver quite impressive. I'm just looking at trial results here now. Quite impressive results at reducing early blight infection. Yeah, 91% is the level of control which they achieved in BASF trials, which is quite impressive. Moving on, they have a new tuber treatment, BAS 700. So that's for rhizotonia, silver scuff, black dot, and a few others as well. Will certainly be useful to some growers who have those problems. BAS 656, again, not named, but this is a new herbicide, which will be very attractive. So well, considering that we've lost Diquat, which would have been the mainstay in weed control in potatoes. That's not expected to be approved till 2024, however. Moving on, BAS 480 for wireworm control. Really interesting product, this. It's a new biological product in development for the reduction of wireworm damage in potatoes. Because it's a biological, there's no harvest interval, which again is quite interesting. Little bit of information about how that works is, well, basically it's a liquid formulation, contains a biological active consisting of a fungus which grows naturally in soils. So I think you're just increasing the level of that fungus in soils, and wireworms come into contact with the fungus, and a combination of anti-feeding, repellent and pathogenic effects occur. Again, that's all we know about this product, but it is coming and it's going to be quite interesting. Also a new aphicide, which is currently undergoing registration. Again, we were given very little information about this other than that it's a new mode of action. So it has no known cross-resistance issues, and that's expected in 2026 and should be cleared for aphids, whiteflies, thrips and other piercing-sucking insects. And then finally, guys, biostimulants as well. BASF are, like many chemical manufacturers, are working on biostimulants, and there's a little bit of information about the biostimulants that BASF are working on and will hopefully have, well, I suppose that will be on trial in Ireland from next year. And look, each of them, there's three of them in development, each of them targeting different stages of the potato life cycle, looking at specific components, trying to reduce abiotic and biotic stresses, healthier plants, higher yields, and all that. So once we know more information about this, and I think it's going to be a big space going forward, we'll obviously bring it to you. That's on the tillage pages. Read it for a little bit more information, and I'm just after giving you on the podcast. Now, moving on, a little bit of news. Siobhan, the Fodder and Food Security Committee, there is some news after emerging from that, and you were involved in it.
So I attended the meeting last week. It was this day last week, last Thursday, and Michael Hennessy spoke from Chagas. So Chagas carried out a number of surveys with their clients, and there was 119 surveys carried out with tillage clients, and it showed that 25% of the people surveyed who were tillage farmers took up the tillage incentive scheme. So I suppose that's a good number. And 93% of those who took it up that were tillage farmers intend to retain this land and tillage in 2023. And I suppose on the contrary then, or on the other side of things, Piers Kelly gave the dry stock results, and there was 936 dry stock farmers surveyed, and 8% of those farmers took up the tillage incentive scheme, but only 40% of that 8% will retain the area in tillage in 2023, and the remaining 60% intend to put that land back into grass by reseeding or having undersown the cereal crop with grass. So I suppose interesting information there. And just carrying on from that, Michael Hennessy said that he expects the tillage area to be up, and that so far they estimate that the seed sales are up by about 5%, but like, you know, maize, beet, potatoes, all these things are still being sown, so I suppose we won't know exactly how much the tillage area is up by until we get those preliminary BPS figures. At the same meeting, I suppose, you know, Kieran McAvoy of the IFA said that tillage farmers are going to need confidence going forward, and, you know, that the tillage season starts in August 2022. So, you know, basically himself and Bobby Miller of the Irish Grain Growers, you know, we're calling for more support for the tillage sector. And I suppose, interestingly, like Bobby brought up about, you know, he asked for feed mills to support locally sourced protein. And we know that when the tillage incentive scheme came in, the government also guaranteed the protein scheme at a minimum of €300. But it now looks like the payment could actually be over €300 because the area looks like it's set to go down. So Michael Hennessy expects the protein area to decrease this year, which I suppose out of the budget of 3 million, we had about 10,000 hectares last year. So if it decreases, the price would actually go over the €300 per hectare mark. And I suppose Michael said that there wasn't strong enough prices coming from industry, you know, at the time of sowing. And he kind of put that down to some of the reason why the area was back. And I suppose that €300 per hectare then maybe came in a little bit late. I'd say it did kind of boost some of the area, but maybe it was too late for some people, and there was high prices for grain at the time, which people probably, you know, they went for the higher prices that were guaranteed. So a few interesting things out of the committee. And I suppose one other thing was that the chair of the committee, Mike McGann, you know, he called for a tillage summit and said that there needs to be some sort of a meeting held, bringing people together to look at where the tillage sector is.
That's what we need, more meetings.
That's, I know, hit, yeah, hit another meeting.
You hit the nail on the head there, so I did.
More meetings, absolutely. More reports. I suppose one thing that they did bring up, it was kind of just mentioned in the middle of the meeting as well, that they're discussing, they said that they were going to discuss maximum residue limits, I think within government and with the industry as well. So, look, they were very vague on it, but presumably that's on grain imports. And, you know, look, I don't know
just,
what
they just, mean. But just explain, yeah, just explain what that is to our listeners who might know.
So I suppose there's maximum residue limits on chemicals that come into the country. So, you know, if grains are over a certain limit, you know, we shouldn't be importing them. So I suppose what they're talking about there is probably, and this is my thoughts on the matter, is to ensure that we have enough grain imports, that maybe they're looking at changing or making allowances on maximum residue limits. But look, it wasn't discussed in detail. It was just interesting to hear it brought up.
Yeah, so in other words, the grain that's imported, they're could potentially looking at increasing the threshold of how much banned chemical on that grain that they're
allowing
into the country.
Yeah, look, that wasn't said at all. They just said they were discussing them. So I suppose we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, this is something that's been coming up at European level for some time. If I can just butt in on it slightly.
Yeah, do, Andy.
You know, one of the things that has been happening for quite a number of years now is that the farming lobby, the tillage lobby, has been saying within Europe that if we're not allowed to use them because you think they're unsafe, then there should be no feed used in Europe with those chemicals on them, either at a level which is below the maximum residue limit that's set internationally, or indeed anything. You know, if we believe that chemical should not be used, then we should not be using any feed that on which they have been used where that product can be found.
Yeah.
That, of course, is sensible from a European perspective, but it's also flying in the face of international trade. And we know, because of the fact that these MRL, maximum residue limits, exist in legal law, in international law and trade, that we will be in trouble if we were to introduce that. So, you know, I dealt with this issue in the Crop Protection magazine. And kind of the only way that I can see it, and it's certainly not the chemical companies that are seeking this change. But if I think Europe probably needs to get up and say, well, look, if there's a reason for something to be banned, it should be a universal reason, or a reason that is universally accepted, so that these products that should be banned are not used anymore anywhere in the world. And that's about the only way you can solve the problem, that all of these regulatory bodies move in unison. It's a big issue, becoming a slightly bigger one, one might say. And in particular, as we move towards increasing pressure from a new sustainable use directive, where we may be set to lose even more products going forward, this issue becomes more and more and more thorny as we go forward. But the only solution that I can see is to have a much more global consideration of what's safe and what's not safe.
Okay, we're going to watch that space carefully, because look, that could be a real bugbear, real issue. So it could, if it happens to materialize. But look, Siobhan, thanks for that report. I'm going to move on to another little bit of news here. Horticulture input costs have increased by as much as 49%, according to Chagas. This is a report by our colleague in the news team, Barry Murphy, online, and he's writing about a recently published report by Chagas. According to the report, input costs for horticulture farmers have increased by between 13 and 49% over the past year, depending on the enterprise. The Chagas Horticulture Development Department have analysed the full extent of input price inflation for the sector for the past 12 months up to the 31st of March 2022, and developed a report which indicates that prices have continue to squeeze margins off the growers. No surprise there. Across all enterprises within Ireland's 477 million euro horticulture sector, there's been a sharp increase in cost of energy, labour, packaging materials, fertiliser, and a range of other inputs that are key to production. Some of the more sector-specific details from this report: the analysis finds that high-wire glasshouse potato, tomato, cucumber and pepper production input prices are up as much as 49% in 12 months. This has been driven primarily by direct and indirect energy price inflation. That makes sense, yeah. Field vegetable producers, who Chagas says are already operating under extremely tight margins, have seen input costs increase in the order of around 26% since March 2021. And the reports also suggest that an 18.5% increase in the cost for the mushroom sector can be attributed to rising energy costs needed for mushroom growing. Chagas says that while horticulture crop input prices have risen significantly in the past 12 months, this was initially due to external macroeconomic factors. However, it says it's more recently linked to the invasion of Ukraine. Guys, just throwing it out there, we still don't have any details about the horticulture support scheme that's coming, don't we not?
I'm not aware of it anyway, Stephen.
Yeah, okay. Well, after this report has been published, it's something that probably should be fast-tracked, going by these numbers. Okay, elsewhere, another little bit of news worth covering. The Energy and Agriculture event is set to take place in Gurcheen College on 19th of July of this year. So, Energy and Agriculture event, anybody who knows it, really good event run by Chagas and a few others as well down in Gurcheen College. Hasn't been in operation because of COVID since 2019, but is back this year. And of course, it's a free to attend event. It's open to all who are interested in reducing energy consumption and increasing the production of renewable energy on farms. And look, the farm renewable energy space has been flipped on its head since 2019. So it's going to be a really interesting show. Four pavilions across the show. We're going to have an energy pavilion. It's going to cover AD, energy policy, solar, electricity, biomass, community energy. Then there's a farm business options, a land use change, a sustainability pavilion, and a one-to-one clinics pavilion as well. Well worth covering. We'll be down there as well. So yeah, look, well worth putting into your diaries. And finally, to conclude for this podcast for another week, Andy, grain markets, what's been happening over the past week? Are we still seeing tentative increases?
Yeah, we've seen both downs and ups, Stephen, is the quick answer. Prices weakened towards the end of last week. But for most of this week, they've been on the rise again. In the paper today, I'm talking about a close of, I think it was 367 for futures for December for wheat. last night, as in Wednesday night, it actually closed at 371. So, you know, we have futures now for new crop wheat on over 370. That may or may not, the gap between futures and physicals is beginning to widen. Beginning to open up. The link is being broken. So looking at the direction of travel of futures is not necessarily going to give you the direction of travel of the physicals, and they can be slower to move. But you know, we're looking at prices that are strong there on wheat. That would put barley price, we've been talking about barley price for the last few weeks, of around the 350s. You know, those numbers would push it maybe closer to the 360s. We saw Glanbia coming out during the week with 310 and 320 for green barley and wheat respectively. And they also had prices yesterday for dry, which I think were 365 for wheat and 355 for barley, if I'm remembering correctly. They're out of memory. So look, things have been moving on. At this stage, I'd kind of nearly be wishing that they would stabilize. I think that this uncertainty is making decisions extremely difficult for everybody. But the bottom line is that there is still a lot of concern as to where the overall supply will be for next harvest. And that's not just a Ukrainian issue. It's certainly a factor, but it's been exacerbated by problems that are occurring in North America, Canada, South America, etc., even parts of Europe, where harvest is expected to be well down on last year. So, you know, markets are still strong, for sure. And forward markets, sorry, if I can make this comment, not forward markets, but nearby markets. Nearby markets would appear to be going off the boil in every sense of the word. Just talking to people, it would seem that, you know, it's not that easy to sell stuff because it's not that easy to get a buyer. And all of a sudden, maize, which is coming into Ireland at about 380, will be moving at equivalent prices around other world markets. And all of a sudden, the fact that it is moving now is freeing up barley. So barley, which was trading above wheat for the last number of weeks, is very quickly after falling below wheat, because there are a number of shippers able to offer barley imports, not just to Ireland, but to anywhere. So look, at all of a sudden we've had these changes that are taking place in the short term. So basically what's happening is that if you look at the futures markets, you have nearby positions coming down, new crop positions rising, and the gap is basically narrowing between the two. So we would always have asked the question, which will move? Will it be the old crop that will fall, or the new crop that will rise, or will it be a combination of both? Well, it seems that time is answering it by saying that it's both, but that the biggest rises are happening on the new crop, with the old crop falling less so. So that's just kind of where we are. Just a very quick comment on oilseed rape. Oilseed rape prices also continued upwards in the past week. They were certainly given additional impetus by the ban on Indonesian palm oil exports that took place at the end of last week. Oilseed rape now for November closed last night at 8.55. You know, they're kind of dreamy prices, but that's what was there. That, I would suggest, would put dry rape price for November probably up around or in excess of 800 euro a ton, which would be, again, very useful and interesting for the potential for margins from that crop. And in particular, when crops look really good, certainly winter crops, they look really good. They're clean to the ground. They seem to be flowering lovely and gently and evenly, which gives rise to a big pod canopy and always the potential for high yield. So rape's looking good. And I know some people who did get into new ground, lay ground for the spring, some of them did opt for rape as the crop to plant rather than going for cereals. So, you know, some people are watching what's going on in the market and where margins can more certainly come from.
Okay. Super, Andy. Thank you very much for that. I'm going to just backtrack for 1 second here. So I am in relation to the support scheme for the horticultural package. We do have details on what was approved, and that's a 2.8 million euro support package, which was approved by Cabinet in the middle of the month. Looking like possibly up to 50,000 euro per hectare of support for eligible glasshouse growers. 4,000 euro expected for potato producers, and 11,000 mooted for the average mushroom grower. We covered that at the time. Still no idea on when that scheme's actually going to be available and launched. So we will watch this space over the coming weeks, because it surely can't be far away. Okay, guys, there we're going to have to leave it for another week. So from Andy, Siobhan, and myself, Stephen Robb, thank you all very much for listening. Enjoy the bank holiday. Stay safe. Stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.